Welcome back, Hemingway listeners, to the Hemingway List, the podcast where we do things the Hemingway, talking about chapter 25 of The American. And did you realize that we are now up to the very last chapter? I didn't realize that until today. I didn't realize as we read chapter 25 that it was the second last chapter, the penultimate chapter, as they say. Tonight's episode of the Hemingway List is brought to you by a big glass of apple juice and two Panadol Rapids. Which I just took. And also the rest of the bottle of apple juice. I really fancied some apple juice, so I grabbed a big glass out of the cupboard, poured it full of apple juice, and then just went, nah, that's not enough apple juice. So I just bought the bottle. So I've got the glass and the bottle on my desk now. Whatever. Don't judge me. I'm an apple juice person, apparently. I'm sniffly. My eyes are killing me. My eyes are killing me. They've been driving me absolutely nuts. I cannot wait for them to go back to normal. That will be bloody excellent. Hence the Panadol. So let's see how we go reading this final chapter. And then tomorrow there will be two podcasts. One will be the wrap-up episode, wrapping up The American, discussing the book as a whole, as well as the final chapter. And then a bit later in the day, we'll have another episode, which will be the first chapter reading of Madame Bovary. So exciting stuff. All right. Naomi, such a headache for her father. And old Deepmere, the sly dog. He was a very sly dog in this chapter 25, appearing out of nowhere in England with the young, what's the word I'm looking for? Coquettish young lady, Naomi. Troublemaker, that girl. Whether or not she intends to be, she definitely is one. I mean, she got bloody, what's his name, killed. I mean, he kind of got himself killed, but you know, it was over her, and she was quite enthralled by the whole ordeal. Acoustic Eel said, this scene in the park reminds me of Anders' previous analysis of the Louvre. I'm just laughing at the word analysis because it was a rant. I'm just going to reword your sentence. This scene in the park reminds me of Anders' previous rant of the Louvre as the one place in all of Paris where anyone ever goes and where everyone keeps running into each other. It's like he picked up a city guidebook, opened it to chapter one, and used the first place he saw as the setting for everything. Only one chapter to go, and I'm already setting the bar low that any of this gets resolved by the end. It was fun to read, I guess, mostly. I'm glad it's not longer, though. Yeah, funny book. I really like, for the most part, especially considering the age of this book, I like his prose style. Very readable, very easy to read. I dislike his structuring, I would say. Very long chapters, and they do play out well. Every chapter plays out well, what am I trying to say here? There was some pacing issues, I suppose, with this book. Captain Venoms said, for me, this chapter was hilarious. Not only does he run into Naomi, he also sits next to Neosh for half an hour, and Deepmere is there too. I absolutely lost it when Neosh used the pug as a tissue. Yeah, that was quite amusing. I need to get a tissue. Excuse me. Oh, I'm so sniffly. You know what's amusing is that my dog is half under my desk right now. She's kind of like hanging out the other end of my desk. And as I walked around it to go and get a tissue, I thought about Neosh using his dog as a tissue and just kind of went, nah, I'll get a tissue. I thought about it for a second, like, yeah, nah. she's not likely to smell as good as a tissue. As being a dog and all. Swim said the mama fishy said, I enjoyed this chapter. Phrases I highlighted. Oh, cool. You highlighted some bits. That's a good thing to do. Had it come to that he was asking for favours from conceited people, he had come very near to being an ass. Ass, spelled A-S-S, meaning a fool or a donkey. Yes, I don't want to say for daisies, and I don't want to say anything unpleasant. For daisies is the plural of plural being for daisies, is a vapid and meaningless remark, commonplace nonsense. But you may depend upon it, all they wanted was your money. Why they stopped wanting yours, I don't know. I suppose because they could get someone else's without having to work so hard for it. Was it from curiosity that you tried so hard to get me to marry her? A little, said Mrs. Tristram. Note, Valentin was also curious what would happen to the Italian woman, as well as Naomi, the latter which got him killed. A curious bunch.
Sniffle, sniffle.
Ah, okay. If you don't like sniffling, you should probably not listen to this episode, because I am sniffly. And it is not pleasant. Carlette said, Ander, in reply to your question, would you have just let it go? Find it really hard to put myself in Newman's position. I wouldn't have proposed to someone I barely knew because a friend put me up to it. I wouldn't have argued with her when she said no. I wouldn't have kept hanging around for months trying to change her mind. If I try to imagine my husband breaking off our engagement before we got married, it's also a very different situation. But even then, even though I love him very much, if he broke it off, I would accept that. You can't marry someone who doesn't want to marry you. A point Newman seems unaware of. The refusal seems to be because of her family, but nevertheless she said no at the first and at the last. There's no way in hell would I go around digging up dirt on the family to try to get my revenge. That wouldn't help matters at all. At least on this last point, Newman seems to have come to agree with me. Yeah. Here's the thing about dating, and I've noticed this when I date women. When they're keen, right, and they want to move forward and, you know, become a couple or get engaged or get married or whatever, if they want to take that next step, they won't let obstacles get in the way. Like, when it comes to matters of the heart, if we really want something, we will, you know, defy everything to get it. People do insane things when they are driven by that. And so when someone says, oh, I really want to, but there's this other thing, you have to kind of take the hint of being like, right, well, they don't want to. Because if they wanted to enough, they would overcome that other thing, right? I don't know, maybe that's a juvenile way of looking at it. Maybe they're just being practical. Could be just that they're being practical. But I think the healthy way to look at it is to, without knowing if they're just being practical or if they are trying to be polite in refusing you by saying, oh, you know, I would, but hey, I'm moving to another town soon, so I can't do it. You don't know if that's the real reason or not, or maybe they just don't want to, but they don't want to upset you. You don't know. But just assume they're trying to be polite about refusing you and don't try to come up with solutions for that refusal. It's really bad tact to try to, when someone gives you a reason why you can't be together, to then try to like patch that reason up. You just got to take it and think, you know what, if they really wanted to make this work, we could make it work, but, you know, a no is a no. That's how I think. So Newman pushed through so many no's, and the whole kind of time I thought, maybe her parents are just taking the hit for her. Maybe she wants to get out of it, but she doesn't want to seem like the bad guy. So mum is just being a good mum and saying, hey, you know what? I don't approve of you. Sorry. It's on me. My bad. You know, I'm the evil one. And just sort of taking that bullet for a daughter. Maybe. I don't know. There's no, like, as we read on, I don't think that the evidence pointed to it being that. But yeah, if I was Newman, I would just go, hey, you know what? All right. All good. I'll move on. Now, I've finished my glass of apple juice. So boy, am I glad that I bought this bottle of apple juice with me. I'm in a bad shape. Oh my God, I hope I feel better tomorrow when I do two podcasts. Although they are two shorter podcasts, so I should be fine. Simply Productive said, well, we've reached the bit of the book I spoiled for myself. Newman has decided not to take his revenge and instead to travel abroad and possibly back home and give this all up as a waste of time. According to Wikipedia, James wrote this book in response to negative stereotypes about Americans. I would say in this he makes an about-face, saying that the old money of the Europeans are portrayed as not being worth the time or energy of a proper good American, that their deceit, backhandedness, and arrogance is small compared to the honesty and hard work of the American. Yeah, I think the American came off, in the end, decent. Sorry. I think he came off decent. You know, a little bit foolish, a little bit ignorant, maybe, but decent, hardworking, good old-fashioned American. What's I going to say about that? I liked this chapter because there was just a bit of good old travel in it. You know, we got to see a bit more of Europe, and I really liked the descriptions of England and how he felt. Kind of, it almost seemed like that's where he should have gone in the first place. You know, Paris was overrated and didn't suit him as well as maybe somewhere like London does suit him. That was the impression I got, and I really liked the descriptions of England, even though we found him in, you know, just a famous park, and then he just runs into the other characters of the book in a humongous city, in a humongous park, in a humongous city, and he runs into not one, not two, but three of the other main characters of the book in one fell swoop. Yeah, it's funny because I did mention that earlier in the book where that kind of kept happening. He'd go to huge landmark places where even if you were there with a friend, you know, they're big places. Big, big places. They're several kilometers squared. So you're not just going to see the other person. Even if you do happen to be there at the same time, in the same place. Big enough coincidence, but yeah. Anyway. Stranger things have happened, I suppose. I need to blow my nose again. I'm going to turn away from the microphone. I don't know why this got into my dog's head ever since she was a puppy, but she seems to think that sniffing or blowing your nose is some kind of a distress call. Because whenever you sniffle or blow your nose, if she's in earshot, she'll like come over all like concerned, like what's happening? All good? We all good here? As if I've called her or something. It's quite strange. Anywho, all right, let's read the final chapter of this book. Chapter 26 goes like this. In that uninitiated observation of the great spectacle of English life upon which I have touched, it might be supposed that Newman passed a great many dull days, but the dullness of his days pleased him. His melancholy, which was settling into a secondary stage, like a healing wound, had in it a certain acrid, palatable sweetness. He had company in his thoughts, and for the present he wanted no other. He had no desire to make acquaintances, and he left untouched a couple of notes of introduction which had been sent him by Tom Tristram. He thought a great deal of Madame de Cintry, sometimes with a dogged tranquillity which might have seemed, for a quarter of an hour at a time, a near neighbour to forgetfulness. He lived over again the happiest hours he had known, that silver chain of numbered days in which his afternoon visits, tending sensibly to the ideal result, had subtilized his good humour to a sort of spiritual intoxication. He came back to reality after such reveries with a somewhat muffled shock. He had begun to feel the need of accepting the unchangeable. At other times the reality became an infamy again, and the unchangeable an imposture. And he gave himself up to his angry restlessness till he was weary, but on the whole he fell into a rather reflective mood. Without in the least intending it or knowing it, he attempted to read the moral of his strange misadventure. He asked himself in his quieter hours whether perhaps after all he was more commercial than was pleasant. We know that it was an obedience to a strong reaction against questions exclusively commercial that he had come out to pick up aesthetic entertainment in Europe. It may be therefore be understood that he was able to conceive that a man might be too commercial. He was very willing to grant it, but the concession, as to his own case, was not made with any very oppressive sense of shame. If he had been too commercial, he was ready to forget it, for in being so he had done no man any wrong that might not be easily forgotten. He reflected with sober placidity that he, at least there were no monuments of his meanness scattered about the world. If there was any reason in the nature of things why his connection with business should have cast a shadow upon a connection, even a connection broken, with a woman justly proud, he was willing to sponge it out of his life forever. The thing seemed a possibility. He could not feel it, doubtless, as keenly as some people, and it hardly seemed worth while to flap his wings very hard to rise to the idea, but he could feel it enough to make any sacrifice that still remained to be made. As to what such sacrifice was now to be made, too, here Newman stopped short before a blank wall over which there sometimes played a shadowy imagery. He had a fancy of carrying out his life as he would have directed it if Madame de Cintry had been left to him, of making it a religion to do nothing that she would have disliked. In this, certainly, there was no sacrifice, but there was a pale, oblique ray of inspiration. It would be lonely entertainment, a good deal like a man talking to himself in the mirror for want of better company. Yet the idea yielded Newman several half-hours' dumb exultation as he sat with his hands in his pockets and his legs stretched over the relics of an expensively poor dinner in the undying English twilight. If, however, his commercial imagination was dead, he felt no contempt for the surviving actualities begotten by it. He was glad he had been prosperous and had been a great man of business rather than a small one. He was extremely glad he was rich. He felt no impulse to sell all he had and give to the poor, or to retire into meditative economy and asceticism. He was glad he was rich and tolerably young. If it was possible to think too much about buying and selling, it was a gain to have a good slice of life left in which not to think about them. Come, what should he think about now? Again and again Newman could think only of one thing. His thoughts always came back to it, and as they did, with an emotional rush which seemed physically to express itself in a sudden upward choking, he leaned forward, the waiter having left the room, and resting his arms on the table, buried his troubled face. He remained in England till midsummer, and spent a month in the country wandering around cathedrals, castles, and ruins, several times taking a walk from his inn into the meadows and parks. He stopped by a well-worn stile, looked across through the early evening at the grey church tower, with its dusky nimbus of thick circling swallows, and remembered that this might have been part of the entertainment of his honeymoon. He had never been so much alone, or indulged so little in accidental dialogue. The period of recreation appointed by Mrs. Tristram had at last expired, and he asked himself what he should do now. Mrs. Tristram had written to him, proposing to him that he should join her in the Pyrenees, but he was not in the humour to return to France. The simplest thing was to repair to Liverpool and embark on the first American steamer. Newman made his way to the great seaport and secured his berth, and the night before sailing he sat in his room at the hotel, staring down vacantly and wearily at an open portmanteau. A number of papers were lying upon it, which he had been meaning to look over. Some of them might conveniently be destroyed, but at last he shuffled them roughly together and pushed them into a corner of the valise. They were business papers, and he was in no humour for sifting them. Then he drew forth his pocketbook and took out a paper of smaller size than those he had dismissed. He did not unfold it. He simply sat looking at the back of it. If he had momentarily entertained the idea of destroying it, the idea quickly expired. What the page suggested was the feeling that lay in his innermost heart, and that no reviving cheerfulness could long quench, the feeling that after all and above all he was a good fellow wronged. With it came a hearty hope that the Bellegardes were enjoying their suspense as to what he would do yet. The more it was prolonged, the more they would enjoy it. He had hung fire once, yes, perhaps in his present queer state of mind he might hang fire again. But he restored the little paper to his pocket, book very tenderly, and felt better for thinking of the suspense of the Bellegardes. He felt better every time he thought of it, and after that, as he sailed the summer seas, he landed in New York and journeyed across the continent to San Francisco, and nothing that he observed by the way contributed to mitigate his sense of being a good fellow wronged. He saw a great many other good fellows, his old friends, but he told none of them that the trick that had been played him. He said simply that the lady he was to have married had changed her mind, and when he was asked if he had changed his own, he said, "Suppose we can change the subject." He told his friends that he had brought home no new ideas from Europe, and his conduct probably struck them as an eloquent proof of failing invention. He took no interest in chatting about his affairs and manifested no desire to look over his accounts. He asked half a dozen questions, which, like those of an eminent physician inquiring for particular symptoms, showed that he still knew what he was talking about, but he made no comments and gave no directions. He not only puzzled the gentleman on the stock exchange, but he was himself surprised at the extent of his indifference. As it seemed only to increase, he made an effort to combat it. He tried to interest himself and to take up his old occupations, but they appeared unreal to him. Do what he would, he somehow could not believe in them. Sometimes he began to fear that there was something the matter with his head, that his brain, perhaps, had softened, and that the end of his strong activities had come. This idea came back to him with an exasperating force. A hopeless, helpless loafer, useful to no one and detestable to himself. This was what the treachery of the Bellegardes had made of him. In his restless idleness, he came back from San Francisco to New York and sat for 3 days in the lobby of his hotel, looking out through a huge wall of plate glass at the unceasing stream of pretty girls in Parisian-looking dresses undulating past with little parcels nursed against their neat figures. At the end of 3 days, he returned to San Francisco, and having arrived there, he wished he had stayed away. He had nothing to do. His occupation was gone, and it seemed to him that he should never find it again. He had nothing to do here, he sometimes said to himself, but there was something beyond the ocean that he was still to do, something that he had left undone, experimentally and speculatively, to see if it could content itself to remain undone. But it was not content. It kept pulling at his heartstrings and thumping at his reason. It murmured in his ears and hovered perpetually before his eyes. It interposed between all new resolutions and their fulfilment. It seemed like a stubborn ghost, dumbly entreating to be laid. Till that was done, he should never be able to do anything else again. One day, toward the end of the winter, after a long interval, he received a letter from Mrs. Tristram, who apparently was animated by a charitable desire to amuse and distract her correspondent. She gave him much Paris gossip, talked of General Packard and Miss Kitty Upjohn, enumerated the new plays at the theatre, and enclosed a note from her husband, who had gone down to spend a month at Nice. Then came her signature, and after this, her postscript. The latter consisted of these few lines: "I heard 3 days since from my friend, the Abbot Aubert, that Madame de Sintry last week took the veil at the Carmelites. It was on her 27th birthday, and she took the name of her patroness, Saint Veronica. Sister Veronica has a lifetime before her." This letter came to Newman in the morning. In the evening, he started for Paris. His wound began to ache with its first fierceness. And during his long bleak journey, the thought of Madame de Sintry's lifetime passed within prison walls on whose outer side he might stand kept him perpetual company. Now he would fix himself in Paris forever. He would extort a sort of happiness from the knowledge that if she was not there, at least the stony sepulchre that held her was. He descended unannounced upon Mrs. Bread, whom he found keeping lonely watch in the great empty saloons on the boulevard Haussmann. They were as neat as a Dutch village. Mrs. Pred's only occupation had been removing individual dust particles. She made no complaint, however, of her loneliness, for in her philosophy, a servant was but a mysteriously projected machine, and it would be as fantastic for a housekeeper to comment upon a gentleman's absence as for a clock to remark upon not being wound up. No particular clock, Mrs. Pred supposed, went all the time, and no particular servant could enjoy all the sunshine diffused by the career of an exacting master. She ventured nevertheless to express a modest hope that Newman meant to remain a while in Paris. Newman laid his hand on hers and shook it gently. "I mean to remain forever," he said. He went after this to see Mrs. Tristram, to whom he had telegraphed and who expected him. She looked at him a moment and shook her head. "This won't do," she said. "You have come back too soon." He sat down and asked about her husband and her children, tried even to inquire about Miss Dora Finch. In the midst of this, "Do you know where she is?" he asked abruptly. Mrs. Tristram hesitated a moment. Of course, he couldn't mean Miss Dora Finch. Then she answered properly, "She has gone to the other house in the Rue d'Enfer." After Newman had sat a while longer looking very sombre, she went on, "You are not so good a man as I thought. You are more... "More what?" Newman asked. "More unforgiving." "Good God," cried Newman, "do you expect me to forgive?" "No, not that. I have forgiven, so of course you can't. But you might forget. You have a worse temper about it than I should have expected. You look wicked. You look dangerous." "I may be dangerous," he said, "but I am not wicked. No, I am not wicked." And he got up to go. Mrs. Tristram asked him to come back to dinner, but he answered that he did not feel like pledging himself to be present at an entertainment, even as a solitary guest. Later in the evening, if he should be able, he would come. He walked away through the city, besides the Seine and over it, and took the direction of the Rue d'Enfer. The day had the softness of early spring, but the weather was grey and humid. Newman found himself in a part of Paris which he little knew, a region of convents and prisons, of streets bordered by long dead walls and traversed by a few wayfarers. At the intersection of two of these streets stood the House of the Carmelites, a dull, plain edifice, with a high-shouldered blank wall all around it. From without, Newman could see its upper windows, its steep roof, and its chimneys, but these things revealed no symptoms of human life. The place looked dumb, deaf, inanimate. The pale, dead, discoloured wall stretched beneath it, far down the empty side street, a vista without a human figure. Newman stood there a long time. There were no passers. He was free to gaze his fill. This seemed the goal of his journey. It was what he had come for. It was a strange satisfaction, and yet it was a satisfaction. The barren stillness of the place seemed to be his own release from ineffectual longing. It told him that the woman within, was lost beyond recall, and that the days and years of the future would pile themselves above her like the huge immovable slab of a tomb. These days and years in this place would always be just so grey and silent. Suddenly, from the thought of their seeing him stand there, again the charm utterly departed. He would never stand there again. It was gratuitous dreariness. He turned away with a heavy heart, but with a heart lighter than the one he had brought. Everything was over, and he too at last could rest. He walked down through narrow winding streets to the edge of the Seine again, and there he saw close above him the soft vast towers of Notre Dame. He crossed one of the bridges and stood a moment in the empty place before the great cathedral. Then he went in beneath the grossly imaged portals. He wandered some distance up the nave and sat down in the splendid dimness. He sat a long time. He heard faraway bells chiming off at long intervals to the rest of the world. He was very tired. This was the best place he could be in. He said no prayers. He had no prayers to say. He had nothing to be thankful for, and he had nothing to ask. Nothing to ask, because now he must take care of himself. But a great cathedral offers a very various hospitality, and Newman sat in his place because while he was there, he was out of the world. The most unpleasant thing that had ever happened to him had reached its formal conclusion. As it were, he could close the book and put it away. He leaned his head for a long time on the chair in front of him. When he took it up, he felt that he was himself again. Somewhere in his mind, a tight knot seemed to have loosened. He thought of the Bellegardes. He had almost forgotten them. He remembered them as people he had meant to do something to. He gave a groan as he remembered what he had meant to do. He was annoyed at having meant to do it. The bottom suddenly had fallen out of his revenge. Whether it was a Christian charity or unregenerate good nature, what it was in the background of his soul, I don't pretend to say, but Newman's last thought was that, of course, he would let the Bellegardes go. If he had spoken it aloud, he would have said that he didn't want to hurt them. He was ashamed of having to hurt them. They had hurt him, but such things were really not his game. At last he got up and came out of the darkening church, not with the elastic step of a man who had won a victory or taken a resolve, but strolling soberly like a good-natured man who was still a little ashamed. Going home, he said to Mrs. Bread that he must trouble her to put back his things into the portmanteau she had unpacked the evening before. His gentle stewardess looked at him through eyes a trifle bedimmed. "Dear me, sir," she exclaimed, "I thought you said that you were going to stay forever." "I meant that I was going to stay away forever," said Newman, kindly, and since his departure from Paris on the following day, he has certainly not returned. The gilded apartments I have so often spoken of stand ready to receive him, but they serve only as a spacious residence for Mrs. Bread, who wanders eternally from room to room, adjusting the tassels of the curtains, and keeps her wages, which are regularly brought her by a banker's clerk, in a great pink service vase on the drawing-room mantel-shelf. Late in the evening, Newman went to Mrs. Tristram's and found Tom Tristram by the domestic fireside. "I'm glad to see you back in Paris," this gentleman declared. "You know, it's really the only place for a white man to live." Mr. Tristram made his friend welcome, according to his own rosy light, and offered him a convenient resume of the Franco-American gossip of the last 6 months. Then at last he got up and said he would go for half an hour to the club. "I suppose a man who has been for 6 months in California wants a little intellectual conversation. I'll let my wife have a go at you." Newman shook hands heartily with his host, but did not ask him to remain, and then he relapsed into his place on the sofa, opposite to Mrs. Tristram. She presently asked him what he had done after leaving her. "Nothing particular," said Newman. "You struck me," she rejoined, "as a man with a plot in his head. You looked as if you were bent on some sinister errand, and after you had left me, I wondered whether I ought to have let you go." "I only went over to the other side of the river, to the Carmelites," said Newman. Mrs. Tristram looked at him a moment and smiled. "What did you do there? Try to scale the wall?" "I did nothing. I looked at the place for a few minutes, and then I came away." Mrs. Tristram gave him a sympathetic glance. "You didn't happen to meet Monsieur de Bellegarde?" she asked, staring hopelessly at the convent wall as well. "I am told he takes his sister's conduct very hard." "No, I didn't meet him, I am happy to say," Newman answered after a pause. "They are in the country," Mrs. Tristram went on, "at what is the name of the place, Fleurières. They returned there at the time you left Paris and have been spending the year in extreme seclusion. The little Marquise must enjoy it. I expect to hear that she has eloped with her daughter's music master." Newman was looking at the light wood fire, but he listened to this with extreme interest. At last he spoke. "I mean never to mention the name of those people again, and I don't want to hear anything more about them." And then he took out of his pocket book and drew forth a scrap of paper. He looked at it an instant, then got up and stood by the fire. "I'm going to burn them up," he said, "and I am glad to have you as a witness. There they go." And he tossed the paper into the flame. Mrs. Tristram sat with her embroidery needle suspended. "What is that paper?" she asked. Newman, leaning against the fireplace, stretched his arms and drew a longer breath than usual. Then after a moment he said, "I can tell you now," he said. "It was a paper containing a secret of the Bellegardes, something which would damn them if it were known." Mrs. Tristram dropped her embroidery with a reproachful moan. "Ah, why didn't you show it to me?" "I thought of showing it to you. I thought of showing it to everyone. I thought of paying my debt to the Bellegardes that way. So I told them, and I frightened them. They've been staying in the country, as you tell me, to keep out of the explosion, but I have given it up." Mrs. Tristram began to take slow stitches again. "Have you quite given it up?" "Oh, yes." "Is it very bad, this secret?" "Yes, very bad." "For myself," said Mrs. Tristram, "I am sorry you have given it up. I should have liked immensely to see your paper. They have wronged me too, you know, as your sponsor and guarantee it would have served me for my revenge as well. How did you come into possession of your secret? It's a long story, but honestly, at any rate. And they knew you were master of it. Oh, I told them. Dear me, how interesting, cried Mrs. Tristram. And you humbled them at your feet. Newman was silent a moment. No, not at all. They pretended not to care, not to be afraid, but I know they did care. They were afraid. Are you very sure? Newman stared a moment. Yes, I'm sure. Mrs. Tristram resumed her slow stitches. They defied you, hey? Yes, said Newman. It was about that. You tried by the threat of exposure to make them retract, Mrs. Tristram pursued. Yes, but they wouldn't. I gave them their choice, and they chose to take their chance of bluffing off the charge and convicting me of fraud. But they were frightened, Newman added, and I have had all the vengeance I want. It is most provoking, said Mrs. Tristram, to hear you talk of the charge when the charge is burnt up. Is it quite consumed? She asked, glancing at the fire. Newman assured her that there was nothing left of it. Well then, she said, I suppose there is no harm in saying that you probably did not make them so very uncomfortable. My impression would be that since, as you say, they defied you, it was because they believed that, after all, you would never really come to the point. Their confidence, after counsel taken of each other, was not in their innocence, nor in their talent for bluffing things off. It was in your remarkable good nature. You see, they were right. Newman instinctively turned to see if the little paper was in fact consumed, but there was nothing left of it. The end. Oh, I like that ending. Very cool ending. Wow. Very, very cool. All right. Well, that's the book. We did it, people. Nicely done. 26 chapters, 26 days. Smashed it out of the park. We'll be talking about this one over at the subreddit. We'll be starting another book tomorrow. Thank you very much for listening, and I will see you tomorrow.